Mormon Stories Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation. All donations to Mormon Stories are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonstories.org. Hello and welcome to another edition of Mormon Stories Podcast. I'm your host, John DeLynn. As always, I'm very excited to have my guest with me here today. Today, my guest on Mormon Stories is Jana Reese. Some of you may know Jana Reese, but my guess is most of you won't. But it's time that you do. Right, Jana?
Well, thank you.
Let's see. If they were to know you, they would know you probably either from your blog, right? Is it called Flunking Sainthood?
It is.
And it's on BeliefNet, right?
Right. It is currently on BeliefNet, and it will be moving in January, but it will still be called Flunking Sainthood.
Okay. But Jana is also the author or the editor of 9 books. Some of you may have heard of Mormonism for Dummies. She is the co-author of Mormonism for Dummies. She wrote a book called What Would Buffy Do? I'm assuming that's Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
That's right.
We'll talk about that in a bit. But we're here to talk about her story, because I've wanted to interview her separate from her new book. But her new book was the impetus to making me want to interview her now. Her new book is called Flunking Sainthood. And the subtitle is A Year of Breaking the Sabbath, Forgetting to Pray, and Still Loving My Neighbor. But most importantly, Jana is, you know, we interview people all along the faith spectrum. And it's usually... It's easy to find people, you know, who are willing to talk that are, you know, disaffected. And there's always some story or angle that can be interesting or intriguing. What's always been harder for me has been to find people who consider themselves believers or happy with the church or, you know, kind of more in the faithful camp that are also I'm going to say super thoughtful, but also super interesting. And that's not to disparage believers at all. But sometimes, an LDS believing testimony can just kind of sound traditional just because there's a certain form that it often takes. But Jana is in no way a traditional Mormon or a traditional thinker or I would say a traditional believer. And that's why I have her on today, because I get a lot of my listeners who say, anytime you can share with us someone who still believes, but does it in an innovative or creative or thoughtful way, we want to hear them. And so, Jana, thanks for coming on Mormon Stories.
Thank you so much.
Do you want to correct any of that introduction?
Well, I'm just sitting here thinking, how in the world am I going to live up to that? Okay, well, here goes.
Yeah, well, we'll do our best. I don't think you'll fail us. I should also mention that you were the... What did you say? The religious book review editor for Publishers Weekly for how many years?
For 9 years.
Yeah, so there's the number 9 again. What is that exactly? What is that position? What does it mean?
So when I was at PW, my job was essentially to sort through every religion book that was being published in North America and then decide based on that maybe the 5-10% that we could cover in the magazine in some way. So it was a great way to keep abreast of what was going on in religious studies and also popular texts about religion. This was the whole time of the Left Behind craze and Purpose-Driven Life and a lot of religion bestsellers. So it was a really exciting time to be in the industry.
What about the whole... You know, the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, atheist guys, Hitchens and Dawkins, were you doing it at that time too?
Yeah, actually I got to meet Christopher Hitchens at PW.
You met Christopher Hitchens?
Did, yes I did.
That's cool.
It was an experience.
I bet. Well, what, and for those who don't know, what is Publishers Weekly?
Okay, sorry, Publishers Weekly is basically the trade magazine for the publishing industry. So if you're in the publishing industry, you probably read PW fairly regularly to know what's going on. Librarians also read it to decide in advance what they might want to order. And it's, you know, it's a fairly influential magazine. It was a great job to have. It's hard in the magazine industry at all right now. So it was good to leave when I did, but it was a wonderful experience.
Hmm. Yeah, it sounds like it. Well, that sounds like a plum job. Although no job is perfect. A couple other things I didn't mention about you, Jana. Jana has a doctorate. Is it a PhD?
Yes.
From Columbia University. Is that religious studies or?
It is specifically in the history of religion in America. So I was focused on the 19th century primarily, and my work since then has actually been more contemporary. So I've strayed, I guess.
You've strayed, but you got a good underpinning in your PhD.
Thank you.
And the other thing that's interesting about Jana is that she is a convert to the LDS Church. And we'll talk about that, but well, let's just dive right in. So Jana, why don't we start as we always do with Mormon Stories and just talk a little bit about whatever parts of your childhood kind of maybe are most relevant or interesting as they inform the spiritual or religious path that you've taken. And we'll weave in the book as it's naturally fitting, but we'll make sure and cover the book heavily at the right point.
Okay. So I guess what's most important to know about my childhood is that it was completely secular and my parents had no interest whatsoever in religion. My mother was not openly hostile to religion, but my father was just full of disparaging comments about religion and religious people and the lemmings that they must be. So it was not a very hospitable environment to grow up in if you were a religious person. And I think inherently I always was. Even as a child, I prayed to God and I believed in God. I didn't quite know what that meant, but I was fascinated by how people practiced religion. I was at camp every summer. I would go on Saturday night to the Catholic Mass, and then I would go on Sunday morning to the Protestant chapel service just because I thought it was so great. And nobody told me that on Saturday night I wasn't supposed to take the wafer, so I did. And then on Sunday I would also take the Protestant communion because, you know, you just got to hedge your bets.
Well, I have to stop you right there because, you know, I'm not happy about this, but it's just kind of a reality. You know, a decent percentage of Mormon Stories listeners have left the church. And from the survey that we've conducted, we found that about 50% of the LDS people that we've surveyed who've left the church or don't believe anymore become agnostic or atheist. And so it's probably alarming and shocking for some to hear that a kid can be raised because many people, when they become more secular, they kind of embrace it and say this is the way to go in maybe almost a religious fashion. And so here we have someone who was raised by secular parents, and it almost sounded like you rebelled.
That is so funny, because that's actually how I describe it in the book, that you have to have something to rebel against as a teenager, and I think rebellion for me in finding religion. So yeah, there's a lot of truth to what you say.
Why would you, like, if your parent, so did they raise you to believe in God at all, or?
Absolutely not. My father was, you know, of the Christopher Hitchens mold, very suspicious of institutions and the damage that they can do. And I think there are very important and valid points in that argument, which we can talk about if you like. But my mother was much more accepting of people's different beliefs, even if she didn't share them. And actually, I would never have predicted this as a child, but my mother then, as an adult, when after I had become an adult, she became a Lutheran, was baptized, actually, in the Lutheran church. I think she was about 50 years old. So she had a very interesting journey to get to that place, but it's not something I ever would have predicted growing up in that environment. You know, that would have been quite the story. And it's so funny because I look around at Mormons that I know, and they're so earnest about the importance of raising their kids in the faith, and that they have to know the articles of faith, and they have to teach their kids every little jot and tittle of religion, or else they might lose their kids. And I just sort of think it's going to happen or it's not going to happen. And just teach them love. That's your most important job. The rest will happen or not.
Right. Wow. Well, so do you have a, what would make a kid who, I mean, okay, I'm just going to put on the secular hat for a second. You know, God and religion is silly. It's manufactured by man. You know, it binds people. It limits them. You know, this is, again, the secular perspective, or one secular perspective. And so a child that's raised without it is a lucky child, because they aren't encumbered by all the limitations and the dogma and the stereotypes. So why would a teenager, like, really, was it just rebellion? Or
no,
did you feel something was missing?
I felt, well, I had a conversion experience, and it's, as conversion experiences go, a very familiar story. I was 14 years old. Gosh, that sounds like Joseph Smith, but believe me, it wasn't at all like that. I was on a retreat with this youth group, a Presbyterian youth group, and we went to this wonderful kind of place where you could ski up in the freezing winter of northern Wisconsin. And on that retreat, I had a really profound experience of God. It was at night. I was sitting on a rock, and I just continued to sit there because I felt that God was trying to speak to me in this ineffable way. And I was almost mad about it. It's hard to describe that feeling. But I had this strong sense that life was about to be interrupted, and I wasn't perfectly happy about it, but I also felt peace over me at that time. And my religious journey has taken some very unexpected turns. I mean, here I am talking to you, and I've been a Mormon now for 18 years. Believe me, I never would have seen that coming, because I was studying to be a Presbyterian pastor. I was Presbyterian through high school and then college, and then I went to seminary. And a funny thing happened to me on the way to ordination, and realized that my theology was taking me in a very different direction.
Hmm. So, but what made you even want to go to those retreats originally? I just want to kind of nail that down. Did you feel a void? Were you just curious? Like, what would make you even want to go to that retreat where you could then have that experience?
I think this is where my conversion story is quite typical, particularly very typical of teenagers, in that it was a very social experience. I had a wonderful friend who had been going to this Presbyterian youth group since she was probably in fourth grade and grown up in the church. And there was community there. There was a strength there that I envied and wanted in my life, even if I wasn't able to articulate it necessarily in that way. And so I was aware on some level that I was there because these people were fun to be with and they were kind. You know, when you're 14 years old, that's not nothing. When you have peers who are kind to you and accepting of you, that is a very powerful pull. So I think that in that sense, it's a pretty conventional conversion. I've been reading this fantastic book called Conversions by Craig Harleen. He's a history professor at BYU, actually, but the book traces a conversion of this Dutch Reformed teenager in the 17th century, and how he leaves his family so that he can become a Catholic, which was, you know, a dastardly deed. And then there's a parallel story of a Mormon young man in the 1970s who has converted to Mormonism, then realizes that he's gay. And so it's almost as though the entire world has been upended by his conversion to Mormonism, and then it's upended one more time because all of those friends don't necessarily accept who he is now. So it's a fascinating book, and I've been thinking a little bit about my conversion as I have read the book, and noticing things that are similar. For example, in 17th century case, Kidd, who converted from the Dutch Reformed religion to Roman Catholicism, he sacrificed a lot to do that, and I think also sacrificed quite a lot when he became a Mormon. But Roman Catholic magistrates and authorities would basically trot him out as an example. See, this must be the true faith if this young man who came from a long line of Dutch Reformed preachers would embrace this Catholic truth. And I've had that happen with Mormonism, and it's a very humbling experience when you realize that someone is listening to your story in order to have confirmation of their own, or disconfirmation in some sense as well. And so that's a lot of burden for a convert to bear. And my faith, I mean, the title of my book is Flunking Sainthood, so you can probably tell how well that's all working out for me. I don't think I'm really the best role model here. But that has been, I don't know, I'm going with this experience. I have loved being a Mormon. So many aspects of it have been absolutely beautiful to me. My conversion to Mormonism was very different, though, in that it was not a social experiment at all. I hardly knew any Mormons when I converted. I knew a couple, but not very many at all. And there was no social gain from making that change in my life. In fact, there would be a tremendous social deficit. It was all because of theology. It was because I was realizing the push factor of understanding that I wasn't a Calvinist, and I was sitting in 8 o'clock theology class studying Calvin and thinking, huh, I really don't buy this stuff about predestination, and I certainly question the whole idea of God's exclusive sovereignty. And the idea of human free will makes a lot of sense to me. So there was that factor. And then I was also learning how to be a pastor, where you actually go and you do work in a church and you practice doing all of the things that a pastor would do. And one of those for me, I mean, I was fine with some of them, like preaching. I loved teaching Sunday school. I enjoyed preaching. But one of them was that every Sunday afternoon, I would go and visit people in the hospital. And I tell you, there are people who are called to that ministry. There are people that, right, I knew in seminary and that I know now who are just called to be chaplains. They are called to sit next to total strangers and hold their hands while they are dying. And boy, did I realize that was not my calling. I felt very out of my depth. I was, 21 years old, 22 years old, and feeling like I had no wisdom to give to this 85-year-old person who was dying.
Right.
So I would come in and just kind of smile and drop off some flowers and a prayer card and feel uncomfortable the whole time, and I'm sure it showed. So that was a bit of a push factor that, wow, maybe I'm really not called to ministry after.
Right. Okay. So so you while you were studying for the ministry, if I got it right, you had a theological kind of crisis of faith. And how did you go from there to thinking Mormonism?
Yeah, that's a bit of a strange story. I had always been very fascinated by Mormonism, not necessarily Mormonism for me, but just Mormonism in general. And when I was in the sixth grade, or I guess the summer between sixth and seventh grade, I took this little summer enrichment class. It was a college for kids kind of experience. And one of the classes that was offered was called Nauvoo and the Mormons. I grew up about 80 miles from Nauvoo, and there was a field trip to Nauvoo. And I thought, great, you know, field trip. I'm always up to go anywhere and have been all my life. So travel even to another town in Western Illinois sounded exciting. So I signed up for that class just on the basis of the fact that there was a field trip and that the boy that I'd been in love with since the second grade was going.
Ah.
So that was a big, important factor as well. But when I was in Nauvoo, I thought, what a bizarre, wacky religion. I went into this room. I don't even remember what building it was in, but it was called the Women's Room. And they had quilts in the room, and they had, you know, photographs of women. And there was this enormous picture of Marie Osmond her mother on the wall. And, you know, I'd grown up watching Donnie and Marie show and worshipped both of them, especially Donnie. And so that made a big impression on me. And actually, I went back 3 years later on another trip, and that photograph was gone.
Oh.
Because Marie had gotten divorced in the intervening times. So suddenly, you know, she's not this exemplary role model for women anymore.
Did they leave Donnie's up?
Donnie wasn't up there. This was the women's room.
Okay.
So it was just all...
Okay. So she got...
Just women and their handicrafts. She did. Yeah. She kind of got the shaft.
She flunked Satan.
But when I was in Nauvoo... Now, keep in mind, I'm only 11 years old here, right? So when I'm in Nauvoo, our group went through the different visitor centers. We went to what was then the RLDS Visitor Center, the LDS Visitor Center. And at the LDS Visitor Center, I was looking in the gift shop at some books and was very interested in reading. I've always been interested in reading. And one of the missionaries who was working there actually chased me down in the parking lot and brought me a Book of Mormon. It was my first ever Book of Mormon. And I never read that copy of the Book of Mormon, but my chief memory of it was that when you opened up the flap, on the inside there was a photograph of this woman's family. So it was, she was like the matriarch, and then it had her grown kids and their children. And it was a family-to-family Book of Mormon program. I don't know if you remember that.
Sure, of course. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, well, I was one of the receiving families of the Book of Mormon
family-to-family
program.
Wow, that program actually worked for somebody.
Well, eventually. Like I said, I don't think I ever read that copy of the Book of Mormon.
Right.
Not until I was older. But I was very interested in what I learned in the class. Mostly, we studied Mormon history, and the teacher of the class was just very interested. I don't think he was Mormon himself. I never really knew his story about why he was interested in this, but he wanted to approach it from the perspective of these were events that happened right here in Western Illinois. In fact, Emma Smith, I found out later, after the Saints went west, one of the many places that she lived was in Knox County, which was where I grew up. So there's another little Mormon connection.
Nice.
Yeah.
Okay, so you had some early exposure to the church. And at what age did you start investigating it kind of seriously?
Well, in my junior year of college, I started doing much more serious reading about Mormonism. And I don't think I could tell you what the catalyst was at that particular time. I don't remember any particular event. But then I decided in the spring of my junior year that I would write my senior thesis on Mormonism and American politics, which is completely ironic because right now part of my life is consumed with planning this conference at Columbia University on Mormonism, American politics. So Randy Ballmer and I are co-convening this in conjunction with the Romney story, the Romney campaign. So it's kind of funny that 20 whatever years ago, my undergraduate thesis was about this topic. And I looked at the ERA, I looked at the MX missile issue, and also African Americans and the priesthood. And it was a very negative thesis. In fact, one of my readers pointed out that I had used the term the Mormon menace in the thesis. Yes. So it's not like I was really looking to convert. And I was horrified about Mormon involvement against the ERA because my mother had been an ERA activist, a pro-ERA activist, and, you know, an early feminist, president of the League of Women Voters, all of those things. And so that was what I grew up valuing. Of course you would want equal rights, and what religion worth its salt would not want equal rights? Duh. That was basically my response.
So far I'm thinking there's no way she's going to end up joining. So there's still something that happens. What happens?
Yes. So I once heard Rodney Stark, the sociologist, speak at a conference of the MHA, and he said, "No one ever converts to Mormonism because of theology. Everyone always converts because of kinship networks, friends, and family."
Right.
And I wanted to just raise my hand and say, well, there's me, because it really was about theology. It was about encountering Mormonism through books and resonating with what I felt was being taught, particularly about the idea of agency, which I found to be profound and beautiful, and not quite the same as agency had been formulated in Protestant theology. In fact, more radical, a little more extreme. Hmm. I found very appealing. Of course, we don't really live as if we believe in agency. I find that Mormons, it's such a damned inconvenient doctrine that we just kind of push it aside. And obedience is so much easier. But agency is a big part of why I converted.
So the whole war in
heaven. And the Book of Mormon. Oh, sorry. Yes. Well, you know, actually, I didn't know about the war in heaven until later. At the time, I was just thinking, oh, wow, human freedom. Wonderful. Free will. But I think that when I did finally settle down to read the Book of Mormon after college, it was another one of those tremendously inconvenient experiences, because I knew it was going to make a claim on my life in a way that I wasn't necessarily prepared for. You have to understand that this whole process, starting maybe with the second semester of my junior year of college, and then finally being formalized in my last year of seminary when I'm finally baptized, that's about a 5-year period or 4.5-year period.
And you don't mean LDS seminary, you mean
No. Yeah. Thank you for that clarification. I mean when I was studying to be a pastor,
right,
and going to Protestant seminary to be a pastor.
Yeah.
So this is a long process and it was very difficult. But when I finally did read the Book of Mormon, basically under duress, because I promised that I would give it a chance.
Did you say under duress? What did you say?
Yes, under duress from a missionary who confronted me. I went the summer after college. I was living in Vermont. It was the best summer ever. And some friends of mine and I had just seen this poster in the student center of a ski house that was sitting empty for the summer. And we thought, let's go to Vermont. You know, we didn't have jobs. We didn't really know anyone in Vermont. But we just had this vision that we would have a wonderful summer in this beautiful place, and we totally did. It was exactly like we had dreamed it would be. But one of the things, I know it was great. One of the things I did on a day off when I was in Vermont was drive up to Sharon, which was not that far away, to see where Joseph Smith was born.
Yeah.
Right. And when I was there, it was almost entirely empty, and there was a woman, an older woman missionary, who really seized upon me as her prey. And I recount this story in the introduction to a commentary I wrote about the Book of Mormon. She asked me, well, have you ever read the Book of Mormon? And I said, I've tried to read parts of it for my senior thesis, but it really didn't grab me. I don't quite understand it. And she said, I just don't think you have the right to judge our religion unless you read the Book of Mormon. Hmm. And I felt, as evangelicals would say, I felt very convicted by that language that she used, because, you know, by that time I'd been a Christian for a number of years, and I always felt that it was unfair for people to judge Christianity without having at least tried to read the Bible.
Right.
And so why would Mormonism be any different? Did I have the right to judge this religion without taking a chance on its sacred text? So I committed that I would try to read the Book of Mormon, and it was really a life-changing experience. I began to realize the Book of Mormon had the same effect on me when I was approaching it prayerfully as the Bible did. And that's not to say that I would ever exclude that experience happening with another sacred text. I think it could. It probably will in my life. But it definitely did with the Book of Mormon, and I recognized it. I recognized that this was, for me, a scripture that would be normative in some way for my life. But that was a really hard thing, because I was between my senior year of college and my first year of seminary, where I was already committed to studying to be a pastor. And then the other thing was that, Book of Mormon or no Book of Mormon, I had very serious problems with Mormonism as it was practiced. You know, the marriage of contemporary Mormonism and conservative politics, the subjugation of women, and I just don't think that another term that is appropriate but subjugation. You can talk all day long about women being separate but equal in Mormonism, women having different gifts. You know, those arguments just don't have any weight with me, because a five-year-old girl can look around when a baby is being blessed in sacrament meeting, as my daughter did when she was five. She is no longer Mormon. And say, Mommy, where are all the girls? So I had very serious obstacles. And when I made the commitment finally to be baptized, it was not because those obstacles had been overcome, but rather because I felt a spiritual confirmation that this long process of coming to understand how God works in my life and also in a particular religion, it's not going to be resolved overnight. And that I had a ministry and a calling to be within the fold of this faith, whether I understood why or not.
Hmm. Wow. So what? How much of your testimony, your early testimony was, oh, I found the true church with God's priesthood and exclusive authority. Was there a shade of that in it? Like, did you buy the restoration idea?
Not for ages. You know, I talked about how this was a process. So here's an interesting story. At least I think it was interesting. I was a member of the church for several years and had not had a patriarchal blessing, and probably would have described myself as one of those people for whom patriarchy and blessing don't necessarily go hand in hand. But I accompanied a friend on her patriarchal blessing, and I saw that it was a very moving and benign experience for her. And I thought, you know, I'm kind of being stupid for just stubbornly holding to this. And one of the other factors in deciding was that by that time I was getting my doctorate at Columbia, and I had met Richard Bushman, who at that time was a stake patriarch in Manhattan, and he was one of my professors. And I had tremendous respect for him. And I thought, well, you know, if it's Richard, then that would be different, and it would be a very beautiful thing. So I'm sure that it will be fine. So I went to him and I asked him this. And I didn't know anything about how things worked in the church in terms of bureaucracy. And he told me very regretfully that it was very unusual for a stake patriarch to be able to give a blessing outside of the stake to someone who wasn't a family member, which I'd never known before. But he did ask. He put up an inquiry, and then it was denied. And after that happened, I was fairly put out, like, the church wouldn't be willing to make an exception for me, even though I'm so afraid of this ritual, and it would be a lot easier for me to have it done by someone I know. I'm not going to have a patriarch family. You know, I don't have any Mormons in my family, so how's that ever going to work? So I sat with this for months and just didn't do anything about it. And finally, I decided I would go ahead and get my patriarchal blessing in my own stake. And so what happened was a very unexpected experience of priesthood. And I don't think I've actually had another experience like that since then. So it's been many years. But the patriarch, who'd never met me before, and didn't know anything about me, mm-hmm. had some very pointed and specific things in the blessing that brought tears to my eyes. And they didn't have anything to do with who I was married to or children that we would have or my future in heaven. It had to do with my job and my ministry in the church. And the word, I'm going to go ahead and tell you all this. The wording that's used is to be leavening in the church and to never be afraid to voice my opinions. That's in my patriarchal blessing.
Holy moly, I wish I had that in my blessing.
I'm totally astonished when I look back on this, because that person didn't know me. I mean, if something like that had come from Richard, I would have said, well, obviously that's Richard and he knows me and he knows how much I'm interested in history, and he knows that I have issues with things in the church. But this guy had met me like 2 minutes before mm-hmm. he put hands on my head. So I had to step back and say, wow, that's pretty powerful and amazing, and experience something that I was not expecting to experience. I had heard stories about other people's patriarchal blessings being fairly pro forma, and I think that the one that I had witnessed with my friend, you know, was fairly standard, and I wasn't expecting anything different than that necessarily. And then suddenly this wonderful thing pops out. So it was a beautiful experience in the end, and I do think about that.
So it's interesting, because you you told that story in response to the question of whether at some point your testimony was rooted in the kind of exclusive truth claims. And I'm wondering how you tie those, or what it was about that question that made you tell that story. Is it because that
you talked about the priesthood? I think it was that.
Oh yeah,
particularly.
So that was something that strengthened your commitment or feelings about or testimony of the priesthood. Maybe.
Well, it certainly helped. I would say that this is something I still struggle with because, you know, my husband is Episcopalian. Just today, I had lunch with one of the priests at his church, and she's amazing. And I would never say or believe that what she does with her congregants is anything less than the work of God on the earth. I look at her and think, what she does is absolutely amazing. And when she goes to bless the sick, how is that different? That part I still don't understand. The exclusive truth claims that we hold are very difficult for me. I was asked to speak a few years ago at an interfaith festival, and it was great that we all had the same assignment. All of the speakers from all of the different religions were told, bring one thing from your sacred texts that would indicate that yours is the only religion that God approves of on the entire planet. And then bring one thing from your sacred texts that invites universalist understandings of the fact that we are all blessed by God and we're all on this journey. And it was amazing to sit there and to hear, you know, these verses from the Upanishads or the Quran, or in my case, the Book of Mormon, and understand that all traditions have this intention somehow, that all religions are working through this issue of exclusive truth, inclusive community, and we still have not figured it out.
So you didn't pull out D&C 1, you went to the Book of Mormon, huh?
Yeah, I did, and I'm trying to remember now exactly what I used.
Well, that's all right.
The inclusive text was, you know, I will take my text here and I will preach it to them and here and preach it to them. One of your listeners is going to be able to tell me immediately where that comes from.
Well, okay, so is it fair to then summarize that you felt called to Mormonism? You experienced, you liked the theology, but you experienced something divine as you read the Book of Mormon and kind of planted the seed and experimented upon the seed and felt called to join. And that seed grew the more you were active and the more time you spent within the church. You had strengthenings of your feelings around priesthood and other things. But never at any point nor now would you characterize your testimony as being either emphasizing or strongly rooted in exclusivity, but instead just in goodness and divinity. Is that fair, or would you say it some other way?
Well, I do think that Mormonism has some exclusive truths that the world could share, and if it darn well wanted to, but so far has not expressed much of an interest. The Book of Mormon being one of those things.
Right.
There's no monopoly that we have on the Book of Mormon. It's open to the world if people would be interested to reading it. For me, I think that it's the institutional claims to exclusive truth and exclusive priesthood that I find problematic, particularly because, and this is that secular childhood come to bear, you know, you never get over your childhood, but particularly given history of how individuals throughout history have used those kinds of justifications in order to commit all kinds of atrocities, and even more benignly than that, just exclusion and prejudices. And I'm not on board with that.
Mm. So for you, sort of one and only true church and all others are false, that kind of language has deleterious side effects culturally that don't resonate with you, and that you aren't going to embrace necessarily.
I think that's fair. I told the story before about sitting in church with my husband on one of the times that he came with me to sacrament meeting, and this guy gets up there and he bears his testimony, about how grateful he is to be part of the true and living church, a member of the true and living church of God. And I turned to Phil and said, sweetheart, you better hurry up or you'll be late for your worship service at your false and dead church. Well, you know, what are we thinking when we use language like that? And here is a lovely, incredible person who happens to be Episcopalian sitting right there. The obvious corollary, if this is the only true and living church on the face of the earth, is that the church that he belongs to and all other ones are false and dead.
False and dead, yeah.
Well, is that really how we feel? Is that really the core of our tradition?
And you know what? Most of the level-headed Mormons that I've talked to about that, they don't want to embrace that. They want to find an interpretation that's more charitable, that's more loving, that's more accepting. So, I mean, in my experience, we seem that, you know, the average Mormon that I talk to wants to embrace truth wherever it comes from and wants to legitimize others. And I think even the church, if you asked Robert Millett about that quote in some, you know, evangelical meeting that he's in, I bet he would lightly dance around that verse, wouldn't you say?
Mm. Well, we all should. We all need to hold that very lightly.
Yeah.
Because when we, first of all, as a pride issue, when we have this idea that we are the remnant, that we are the sole bastion of truth upon the earth, that is not Jesus. That is not of Jesus. And Jesus was constantly warning people against religious pride. So beware, you know, all ye who enter here, beware.
Right, right. Okay, the two most deliciously, beautifully ironic or unexpected things about your story so far are that you were raised in a secular home, yet you felt pulled towards faith. I think there's a lot of nervous disaffected Mormons right now, but it sounds like you've had a delightful journey, so it's not in any sense a cautionary tale. But the second is that you were feminist, you were, you know, for social justice, you had problems with patriarchy, you knew about all the weirdness, and yet you still felt drawn to this thing. Like, I asked myself, is that possible? Like in 2011, Could a Jana Reese join the church today? And I'm just curious whether you have a perspective on that.
Absolutely, because sometimes those people write to me. And, you know, I hear from people who are in what I would call a liminal space. Sometimes we'll receive emails, sometimes very painful ones.
Tell us what that word means.
In between, in between space.
Okay,
so people who grew up in the tradition or converted and are on their way out, for whatever reason, and there are a lot of really good ones. And then people who have discovered this, and there's a part of them, there's that yearning to believe, like in Alma 32, which you referenced a few minutes ago, that desire to believe, but you don't necessarily want to give place to it because it's going to change your life, because people will laugh at you, for whatever reason. I hear from people on both of those extremes. And in some ways, they're asking many of the same questions. Is this truth worth giving my life over to? And I can't answer the question for those people. All I can do is listen to them and say, you know, yeah, I've been there, or actually, I really haven't. But people need a compassionate ear. And I think that from some of the new converts and potential converts that I hear from occasionally, it is really fairly encouraging, actually, that somehow, despite a lot of issues that might drive people away from Mormonism, like Proposition 8, for example, there is this beauty, there is this truth, and there is this community that is very attractive. And so we have so much to offer, and we have so much that's good, but sometimes it's very hard to see that.
And yet you've stuck around. You've hung in there, right?
Except for 1 year. I took a sabbatical in 2000 to 2001 for basically an academic year, and stayed home and read the New York Times on Sundays and went to my husband's church sometime. And it was hard to explain to people because in Mormonism, we don't have any concept of sabbatical. You know, we don't go on retreats. All we do is advance, right? We're all about the army of Helaman marching forward. We know the truth. We never take a break, blah, blah, blah. Well, I needed a break. It was either take a break or leave back. That was 12 years ago almost now.
Was that Prop 22? What was that? Was something going on?
That wasn't actually about politics. That was not related to national issues or of any import. That was really more where I was spiritually and also geographically, to be honest with you, because we moved in 1999 to rural Kentucky. And it was, you know, we moved from Princeton, New Jersey. That was the only ward I'd ever known, was in Princeton, New Jersey, which, as you can imagine, is kind of one of those holy grails of Mormonism. And I didn't appreciate that at all at the time. I didn't know anything about what the rest of the church was like. We had a great choir. We had two gospel doctrine classes, one of which was wonderfully liberal. My bishop was for gay rights. I mean, yeah, okay. I never really knew what life was like outside of this wonderful little bubble that I lived in. And a lot of people were students, you know, grad students and whatever. And then I went to rural Kentucky and encountered a completely different kind of experience of the church. And that ward also had some organizational behavior issues that made it a very dysfunctional environment. It changed. It actually got much better in the time that I lived there, not because of me, but because someone who needed to die actually died. And I'm so sorry to have to say that, but sometimes you need to have that funeral, you know. Oh, I hope you'll edit that part out. Anyway, so
I won't ask you what town. I won't ask you what town you lived in. How's that?
No. Well, I think, you know, people who know me probably know where it was, and it was a loving. It became a very loving community, but it's interesting how sometimes if you do have a very powerful person who is a very negative, toxic person, it can poison an entire community, and that's not just Mormonism. That's wherever you work. That's also if you happen to go to some other, you know, synagogue or temple or that can happen anywhere.
Right.
So after about a year and a half of feeling like I was kind of banging my head up against the wall in this community, I decided to take a sabbatical. And it was hard to explain to people because we don't have the language for that. We don't have any category for that. And at one point in the middle of the year, I ran into one of the sweet sisters from the Relief Society at the grocery store. And she said, oh, we missed you and we hope you'll come back. And I said, I'll be back on September 1st. You know, like I've got it all planned.
Oh, wow.
Exactly.
It was like a 12-month period.
Well, you know, it was very exact that I was going to be gone for this academic year. And so her eyebrows sort of lifted, like, huh, really? You'll be back September 1st. And what was particularly interesting about it was that I did come back at the very beginning of September in 2001, which, as you know, was a rather inauspicious time to return to religion. And I returned, though, with this renewed sense of calling and vigor. And I had actually been reading my scripture more, felt a great commitment to personal spirituality that I hadn't in a long time before that. So when September 11th happened, I actually just called the person who was one of the counselors in the bishopric, and I told him my big fear was that I would go to church on Sunday after September 11th, and we'd be having a talk about tithing, or we'd be doing something completely irrelevant to what everyone was thinking and praying about and grieving about. And so he said, you're right, and we will definitely do that. And can you talk? You know? So that's Mormonism for you. If you have a complaint about it, you better be ready to correct the problem. But I talked to a friend of mine who, on the Sunday after September 11th, they went to their ward, and one of the assigned hymns, I swear to God, was "There is Sunshine in My Soul Today."
Oh! What?
Yes! What were they thinking? I mean, how is it? How is it even possible that we could be so liturgically stupid so as not to recognize this tremendous grief and pain? That's another topic for another
time. We got you going on that one. Okay, so, and I'm just going to ask you this really quickly. There are a lot of people who are feeling a lot of pressure about, activity and they're just not feeling happy at church. Did you find that taking a sabbatical was healthy for your testimony or healthy for your relationship with the church?
Definitely.
How's that?
I definitely did. Well, we have sabbaticals in all of these other areas of our lives that are fairly demanding areas. People take vacations from work. Sometimes parents will take a vacation from their kids because that's demanding. And we have sabbaticals for academics so that they can go and be creative and focused about something. Why don't we ever think to do that with our faith? I mean, for centuries, other Christian traditions have sent people on retreat, whether it's just for a week or possibly for 3 months, or they go on pilgrimage. There are all sorts of wonderfully sanctioned ways in which to step back from your ordinary life and think about God in a new way. But we don't have anything like that. We don't go on retreat. We don't go on pilgrimage. We don't take sabbaticals. We don't take time off. Everything is about doing, 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 constantly moving ahead for God. You cannot sustain that. You cannot sustain that pace. And the people that I worry about most, frankly, are these wonderful men who serve as local church leaders who, God bless them, tend to get promoted in the church because it's a corporate structure and they do well in their very demanding careers, right? They're also often the same people who have large families. So you might have a demanding career, a large family, and a church calling that takes up 15 to 25 hours of your week. Now, how does that compute without someone basically going barmy?
Right.
Yeah. It doesn't make sense.
Yeah. Yeah, but what if your stake president called you up and said, I heard on a podcast you were telling people to take a year off church? What would you say?
I would say, yeah, of course. I said that, and I believe it. If that's the question, if they're on the verge of leaving or taking a year off, it should be an obvious question. One of the issues with Mormonism is that so many people have an either-or mentality about a lot of things. You know, we've talked about the question of, is it the true church or not, as though there's a pure dichotomy in which those are the only two options, right?
Right.
But also have that mentality about how we pursue our lives. And frankly, that was one of the things that I had in my mind as I was writing Flunking Sainthood, because I know people like me who maybe have a perfectionist tendency. We want to do our best, and that is a very godly, beautiful desire. Well, sometimes it is. It can be a very godly and beautiful desire. But when we fail, and we will fail all the time, if we have that mentality that we are only acceptable to God when we are perfect, then we leave. You know, people will throw out the baby with the bathwater. And I hear those stories again and again in Mormonism. Maybe it's that they've been told all their lives that the church is true. There is no error here. There is no room for human machinations in our theology. Well, of course there is. And history proves that. You know, we have lots of problems with historicity, Book of Mormon DNA, Book of Abraham. I mean, it doesn't take any kind of genius to be able to tick off a lot of things that just look a little bit off about our religion. And if there's no spirituality at the core there, and people have been told all their lives that it's an all or nothing proposition, they have no choice but to leave. But it isn't an all or nothing proposition. It isn't.
It isn't. What is it?
It is a both and.
And you talk about this in your book. We'll get to your book, but when you talked about, you know, reading the scriptures in depth for a month, it seems like the lesson from that was you were reading intellectually, right?
Well, that's how I tend to approach the Bible, as if someday I'm going to be, you know, on Jeopardy and have to answer all these questions about Bible trivia. And in that chapter of Flunking Sainthood, I was trying to get past that mentality. This is not pure information, that this is
spiritual,
supposed to change me in some way. Right.
Right.
And in what way am I supposed to be changed by this?
Right. So I have to ask, since you brought it up, how do you maintain I mean, I'll refer to the survey a million times over the next year, but Book of Abraham and Book of Mormon were like top five issues for people that have caused them to leave. And a lot of us just have the assumption that the only people, you know, who haven't left are the ones who don't know about Book of Mormon and DNA and the Book of Abraham, you know, and everybody else has left, you know. How in the world do you stay knowing about that stuff?
Well, I don't know that this is going to be a satisfactory answer, to be honest with you, because one of the things that I have found is that some of the people, most of whom are men, who get very exercised about being in the know about what really happened with the Book of Abraham, etc., are not persuaded by arguments that rest on spirituality. They only want arguments that meet them point for point, saying, if and this is an either-or proposition as well, the whole way they approach the question.
Yeah.
If the Book of Abraham is not a divine translation of this ancient document, if it is, in fact, just an ordinary funerary document that Joseph Smith completely expanded, embellished, elaborated on, or if you're looking at a more cynical view, just simply lied about, then what do we do with the rest of our faith? Well, let's step back, first of all, and think about how important is the Book of Abraham to the Mormon faith in general. I don't think it's terrifically important, but that's just me. Mm-hmm. But we need to have a tradition of Midrash. We need to have a tradition where we can look at a prophet in the way that Jews have looked at prophets of old and say, this is a Midrash on a revelation, or this is a Midrash on an earlier work of Scripture.
What does that word mean? What does that word mean?
Midrash, well, it's basically an teaching. It is.
Wait, you cut off for a second. Say it one more time.
I would say it's an expanded teaching.
Okay.
I don't know what the exact definition would be, but an expanded teaching, something where in Midrashim you are taking a core text and then thinking about it cosmically. You're thinking about it theologically, and you could look, for example, at the entire Pearl of Great Price as a Midrash. You have Moses as a Midrash on Genesis, right? If you think about it in those terms, the literal nature of it is less important than what the book is trying to teach us about who we are as children of God. I think that is where we need to be looking. And I frankly don't give a hoot about some of the arguments about historicity, DNA. The more troubling is of course Joseph Smith. The more troubling aspect, not the scripture in and of itself, but what Joseph Smith said about it and whether he can then be relied upon as a prophet of God. And based on my work in the Hebrew Bible, I would say, yeah. Have you looked at those guys lately? I mean, we have this completely ridiculous idea of what a prophet is supposed to be. No human being can measure up to that. And there's certainly no biblical example that actually does. And yet we conveniently forget about it. We come up with these stupid gospel doctrine lessons that encourage us to look at people in the Old Testament as if they were perfect. And then we set up our own leaders to be perfect as well. And when they aren't, well, we leave.
Right. And then that all is a compelling or a, you know, a viable intellectual response. And I want to dig into that a bit in a second. But it sounds like what you were also going to say is there's a strong spiritual component to it as well. Is that right?
Yes, there is. And I worry that we don't emphasize deep reading of Scripture in the way that we ought to. We talk about reading the scriptures all the time. Don't get me wrong, and I think that's an important devotional practice. I think our church actually does a fairly good job of encouraging people to dig into the scriptures every day. But we're doing it for that informational thing that I was talking about before. We're doing it so that we can learn the scriptures. We have the same thing when we go to the temple. The temple is not a worship experience. The temple is a learning experience. It's instruction. And that's not at all the same. We don't have any corporate worship in Mormon culture, and that's a huge problem. I think if we have more authentic experiences of worshiping in community, of reading the scriptures together in community, not in the gospel doctrine sense, where we're there to learn about so-and-so, but in the sense where we have a small group of people who get together, who read the scriptures, who pray together about the needs in their lives, that is a completely different understanding of the scriptures. And we don't do that. I have no idea why we don't.
Mm. And yet you feel, it sounds like your Mormonness has been overall spiritually edifying for you, and that's part of what's kept you around, right? So have you just had to supplement on your own, or?
I do a lot of supplementing, yes. That's well said. Yeah, I do. I do a lot of supplementing. And I think that's one of the blessings of having not grown up in this tradition. I worry about people who basically feel that they have to leave Mormonism because they are convinced that the world out there is so much better, right?
Right.
It always is going to look that way. Sometimes it actually is that way. But they don't understand that it is possible to learn from other traditions without leaving your own, and to instead that bless and enrich your life as a Mormon. You know, I've been enriched as a Mormon by studying Buddhist texts from Tibet and about mortality and Tibetan prayer beads and how they sit and think about death, because the prayer beads are actually made of human bones and skulls, and they sit there and they touch them. I think, yeah, I'm going to die. How does that change the way I live now? I want to clarify that I don't actually have such a rosary. I don't I don't have anything that's constructed out of human bones and skulls. But the idea of it, just the idea of it, has transformed my spirituality and how I think about prayer and mortality. The fact that this is so fleeting. We are here for such a short time. We have to think about that every day.
Hmm. And so, and you know, I'm going to kind of just use this as a way to kind of close this first hour. So don't think I'm going to now dig into some big deep exploration of this, but well, I guess I have two questions. One is, and I won't ask them at the same time. So the first question is, what about the person that says to you, no, Jana, like, either the Book of Abraham is what Joseph Smith said it was, or it's a fraud. And either the Book of Mormon is what Joseph said it was, or it's a fraud. And truth actually matters. Facts matter. And a fair, you know, reading of the archaeological, anthropological, genetic, whatever evidence of the Book of Mormon, and a fair reading of, you know, the text, you know, the funerary text that Joseph claimed to have translated the Book of Abraham, you know, from, you know, points that it was not true. And if it's not true, I'm out of here, because it's based on fraud and deception and isn't what it claims to be.
But you're defining truth in this incredibly narrow way when you do that, or not you personally, but anyone who does that. You are defining truth in the way that Enlightenment philosophy has taught us to define truth, which is that it is factual, that is historical, that is epistemologically verifiable, right? Well, truth does not have to be factual, historical, or epistemologically verifiable. It's awfully nice when that happens, because we can explain it to our friends and not sound like spiritual idiots. But I'm afraid it doesn't always work that way. And I think it bothers me. God bless the people at FAIR. I think they do wonderful work, and it's very persuasive for some people. But they're not asking the bigger question, at least sometimes, about why is this important? I once heard a fantastic sermon when I was in seminary. It was called The Second Question. And the preacher, this professor, had been to a magic show by Penn and Teller. Mm. And the guy behind him just basically spoiled the experience for the preacher by saying, oh, I know how they did that. I know how they did that. And at one point in the show, either Penn or Teller said, probably there are some people out there who are saying to themselves, I know how they did that. Hmm. But that's not the important question. The important question is, why do we do that? Why do we do this every day? And so the preacher then extrapolated from that this whole sermon called The Second Question. And if we were to apply that to this situation, for example, using Book of Mormon DNA.
DNA.
As our test case,
okay.
Right?
Okay.
The problem with the Book of Mormon DNA is that it demonstrates that you have this understanding of the Book of Mormon that simply cannot be factually true. And they're right. It cannot be factually true in that sense. Why does it have to be factually true? And this is where I really disagree with Terrell Givens that you had on your show. And I love Terrell, and I think his work has been so important. And I think it's awesome that he came on your show.
Yeah.
But Terrell sets up this situation in By the End of Mormon where he says, if you don't believe it happened this way, everything else falls apart, that the rest of it hinges upon the literal nature of this. And I think that when we do that, we are setting everyone up to fall because, first of all, it may not be factually verifiable. But why do we care about that? I think we care about it into a ridiculous degree because we're concerned about how it all sounds to other people. We are a persecuted religious minority. We're very sensitive about how our faith plays in Peoria, which, by the way, it doesn't, because I grew up near Peoria, and I can tell you it totally doesn't. Yeah. So the apologetics issues and the questions that are asked, let's get to the second question. And let's look at some of these scriptural texts prayerfully and ask God before we even start reading, what do you want to teach me from this? How does this have bearing on my life? And that's a very transformative way to approach the scriptures.
So you're saying, forget if Mormonism is factually, historically what it claims to be. Live it, and if it transforms your life, then you've enjoyed a transformed life. Is that what you're saying?
I don't think it's quite as reductionistic as that. I mean, this is not Pascal's Wager, where we are just saying, I'm going to live as if this were true and see what happens. Because there is an element beneath this entire experience that is that seed of faith, that yearning, that desire to believe. And that undergirds everything else, that undergirds every spiritual question. But I think that you're right when you say at some point there is this point where it's a leap of faith and you do take that faith leap on faith, as they say, for better or for worse. But I think you have to do it with both eyes open. And this is where I look at some of the people I know in church, and it all just seems to come so easily to them. And of course, this is all true. And I was raised on this with my mother's milk, and how dare you ever question this? And, you know, that is so immature. That is as immature as it is for someone to say, well, this one thing wasn't factually true, so I'm throwing it all out because it's all lies. We have to grow up. And that's the whole point of Mormon theology, where the burden is upon us with our agency that we need to search for truth.
Right. So you're not saying truth doesn't matter. You're saying there's got to be a core hope or belief that at some level there's some validity and truth to what's going on. And then from there the struggle can be the struggle is part of the point. It almost seems like
yes, it is. Well said. The struggle is part of the point. And I think when Pilate makes this comment that just seems like a throwaway afterthought, ha, what is truth, as though that's this kind of cynical approach, I'd like to give him the benefit of the doubt here. I'd like to think that actually there's a part of Pilate that really wants to know, what is truth to you, Jesus? Because you're totally blowing my mind. And why don't we have that curiosity ourselves? There's a Gnosticism to people who say, I have discovered the real truth, whether it's the conservative Mormons who believe that they have discovered the real truth and everything else is crap outside the church, or it's the disaffected former Latter-day Saints who say, I've discovered the real truth about the Book of Mormon or the Book of Abraham and everything else is crap. That's Gnosticism. When we believe that some sort of sacred secret teaching has awakened us and opened our eyes, and that everyone else is in the dark. That is not Christianity.
And for someone who didn't believe in Christ, what would you appeal to? It's just not what, mature or broad thinking or enlightened?
That's a good question. Yes, I think it is not spiritually mature. And if we, as progressive people, want to be able to say that we are, in fact, progressive people, we need to entertain other points of view. And I find that on both of those extremes, there's often a hardness and a coldness to investigating new truth. And I worry about that.
Right. And isn't that, if I'm just going to play pro-LDS for a second, isn't that one of the beauties of what Joseph Smith left us? Is a legacy of, we will follow the truth and be willing to accept new truth when it comes?
You know, I'm so pleased that you brought that up, because unfortunately we don't live that way. And it comes in even how people talk to me about my conversion. I converted in 1993. That's the official story, right? But I am always converting. I am on a journey of conversion, and I'm not the same Christian that I was in 1993 when I became a Latter-day Saint Christian. And I won't be the same Christian in 18 years from now.
Right.
I am always converting, and I hope that I am always going to be open to new truth and wherever God leads me.
Yeah. Right. Okay, in the last part of this segment, I'm just going to kind of bring it back to your childhood for a second. I mean, so right now, based on our data, you know, people are leaving the church at an exponentially increasing rate, and intellectual issues really are most prominent. There are spiritual reasons people leave. There are, you know, cultural or political reasons people leave. But by and large, it's the types of things we've been talking about today. And I think it's important to look ahead and see where that takes future generations a bit. Because, and I'm sorry, this is a bit long of a statement, but, you know, I sat across the table from Sam Harris. I had lunch with Sam Harris. And I sat across the table with Michael Shermer. I had lunch with Michael Shermer. And these are, you know, two of the world's great atheist, you know, writers and thinkers. And I asked them point blank. I said, when my wife gets cancer, when is one of your people going to be showing up at our door delivering a casserole, you know, in Logan, right? Like, and what I mean by that is, and I don't just mean it socially. I mean, if you believe in evolution at all, and most people who leave the church probably do, you would probably concede that if religion weren't adaptive for the human species, it would have died out, right? It would have gone the wayside. But actually, my understanding over the past century is mankind's gotten more religious, not less, overall. Even though right now there might be a bit of a waxing and waning going on. And so I think there's a lot of people right now who are leaving religions, leaving Mormonism, sort of envisioning this post-religion world where religion's dead, and we as soon as we can shake off the chains of religious, you know, oppression, then rainbows will emerge and it'll rain gumdrops and butterflies will fly around.
Oh, unicorns. Don't forget the unicorns.
Unicorns will come out and we'll all be enlightened. And it's just fascinating to ask, what if Janna Reese, you know, what if Janna Reese is one of the outcomes of this, you know, this mass movement towards secularism? In other words, what if we just ain't escaping this religious thing as a species anytime soon? And the minute that we think we are, as Greg Prince said, atheists are having a hard time keeping their children in the fold. What if we're going to boomerang? what if we're going to boomerang whether we want want, you know, what if society's going to boomerang back to religion, whether we want it to or not? And if it is, then why not stay and make it as great of a place for our grandchildren if they're going to end up back here anyway? That was not even a question. I'm embarrassed that I just said all that and didn't even shape it into a question, but feel free
to
comment.
You have nothing to be embarrassed about. This is a conversation. It's not an interrogation. You have nothing to be embarrassed about. Well, the things that occurred to me while you were talking, first of all, I can understand that people within Mormonism would be very concerned about disaffection, disaffiliation, people leaving the church. It is a concern. And I sure hope that people at the church are taking notes on why this happens and that they are planning to make changes in the way we do things, particularly the way we set up these either-or dichotomies in which people are essentially forced out if they have questions. But I would also say, and I think you alluded to this, that this is not just the trend within Mormonism. The trend toward disaffiliation is happening everywhere. And it's a really fascinating moment in American culture. I read a book a few years ago by Christian Smith called Soul Searching, where he was looking research on teenagers and religion. And then he followed up with those same teenagers some years later when they became young adults, so college age and in their early 20s, to find out specifically what happened to those kids, but more generally what's happening to this whole generation. And I really recommend reading those books in tandem because it's quite illuminating of how this is affecting. In the first book, Mormonism comes off very well, actually, because Mormon teens at least know what they're supposed to believe, and they report praying regularly. You know, they report devotional practices that would demonstrate some kind of personal commitment. But even those things are not really enough to hold people in the fold. And so more recently, just last year, Oxford published another book by Kenda Creasy Dean, who had been one of the researchers on the Youth and Religion Project that Christian Smith started. I hope this isn't, you know, boring people, but the upshot is that she had a whole chapter on Mormons. Are they the success story, you know, in how their kids are learning the faith, being indoctrinated in the faith, and then staying in the faith? And I think the chapter was very good in terms of how it examined Mormon kids and how they are enculturated. I don't think it did such a great job of looking at the darker side and the fact that a lot of these people then leave. Even returned missionaries will come home and sometimes leave for whatever reason. People you would expect to have the highest commitment, levels of commitment to the faith. But much of that is because we are living in a culture in which now 14% of young adults claim no affiliation. So that is a significant change, even from a couple of decades ago when it was more like 6 or 7. It has doubled. So it's not just Latter-day Saints.
Yeah. Yeah, but and that's all true. And in Europe, religion's really struggling. And there are some predictions that in like 9 countries across the world, religion will become extinct. But that's kind of what I'm wondering is, I wonder if in the human condition, there's just no escaping God and belief, you know, it overall. I wonder if we're destined as a species to boomerang back to faith, or if science or social engineering is gonna someday, you know, lead us to a better place. Have you thought about that at all?
I have thought about it some, but probably not enough. I think those are important questions for the future, but no, I don't have any grand sweeping wisdom to give you.
But as far as you're concerned, what you represent to me is a testimonial that it's not as simple as yank your kids out of church, you know, and teach them the secular ways, because somehow, at least for some, that spirit just calls them right back, right?
Sometimes that happens.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I remember a Speaking of Faith episode with Krista Tippett, where there were these, you know, liberal, loosey-goosey Catholics who raised their kids, you know, outside the faith. And lo and behold, by the time they were young adults, they were like fundamentalist Catholics. Have you seen that dynamic happen in Judaism or in other religions? Is this...
Yes. There is a whole kind of reverse trend, and it is very interesting to observe. I think the book that you're referring to from the Krista Tippett show is called The New Faithful. Colleen someone, I can't remember her last name, but she was looking at this phenomenon precisely of people who you would think are going to embrace largely secular values and then take a turn for conservative religion, in that case, conservative Catholicism. Why? What is it that they are finding there? And I think that the reductionistic sociological answer is that people want to know what they're supposed to believe, and never more so than in a time of confusion more generally. I don't think that that kind of explanation gives people very much credit, and it doesn't hold true with people that I talk to. They don't say, I wanted to know the truth so that my life would be simpler. Their lives are rarely simpler because of the changes that they've made.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. Music today was provided by the Saber Rattlers. Check them out at saber-rattlers.com. The Mormon Stories logo was generously donated by StudioCase.com. Thanks for listening.
Come, come, ye saints, no toil nor labor fear, but with joy wend your way. Though hard to you this journey may appear, grace shall be as your day. Tis better far to drive, do this and joy. Your hearts will swell. Oh, all is well. All is well. Why should we mourn? I think our lot is hard. 'Tis not so. just we shall dwell.